listening to season 2 of PraroPod.
We are sisters, one West Coast,
one East Coast,
one straight mom of toddler twins,
one gay, multiply divorced,
one lifelong Agatha Christie fan,
one new reader.
Season 1 got the two of us through the first shitty year of COVID. Follow along with us for season 2 as we drink. And sometimes remember to talk about the book. Hello.
Well, hello.
After a long summer break.
Very, very long.
We are back to PraroPod.
PraroPod is back.
Yeah, this has got to be a new season.
Okay, this is season 17 or whatever it is. And we're not doing a new intro. I think season 2 is just the forever season.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. Or we should do one that doesn't necessarily relate to COVID. Because COVID is just, new normal. I hate saying that. I guess we do need a season 3, and that can be the forever season, because season 2 was intended sort of like as the second year of COVID.
Right, right. But we are.
So we're back finally.
Yep. Since we last talked to you, we all flew to Norway with our family, had a wonderful time, came back. My kids are in preschool. Like, when we started this, I remember telling a story about Annika as a baby pulling all of the Agatha Christie books off of the shelf.
Totally. Right?
And now she's 4, you know? I mean, well, you know, so.
Yeah, it's true. It's a lot more. Yeah. Everyone's grown.
Everyone's grown.
I mean, only your kids are 4 years older. I am not.
Right. We are exactly the same age. My eyes are not getting worse by the day at all. Anyway. So we are back and we're doing a non-Poirot or Miss Marple book or any of the names.
That's actually a good point. We didn't write that in our notes, but that's actually something that's very interesting about it is that it's none of our detectives.
None of our detectives. This is a new person who solves it named Charles. I can't remember his last name, but I don't know if it matters. Charles, random British dude.
No, don't stop it. We know we have the help of
Wikipedia.
And you read it with your eyeballs, so you should remember. Okay, let's see.
Oh, I've scrolled down. Charles Hayward.
Hayward.
I am sorry, but his last name isn't particularly important to the story, so.
No, but he and his dad are in it, so you got 2 Haywards. Oh yeah, here's our list of characters. We got Charles Hayward, and then we got
Sophia.
No, but I was looking for Sir Arthur Hayward, his dad.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's the assistant commissioner.
Right. So Charles.
Okay, wait. Set the scene. Set the scene. What's happening here, Portia?
So we meet Charles during the war, maybe, or right after the war. But anyway, he's in the Middle East. So I think he was.
Yeah, it was towards the end of the Second World War.
And he was
in
the Middle East.
He's in Cairo.
Doing colonizer things. And yeah. And then he meets Sophia. How do you say the last name? It's Greek.
Leonidas.
Leonidas. So we meet Sophia, who also has a job being a colonizer. She works for the Foreign Office, which I'm guessing is colonizer things.
bureaucratic colonizing.
I mean, if you know,
filing forms about colonizing.
You know what? These are the 2 things that the Brits are good at. I've never been there, but this is one of the reasons I love The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe, because it is science fiction written by a British guy. And it's funny.
Oh, right. You talk about how they talk about like queuing up.
Right. It's like, well, I'm British. In space. I know how to queue, you know? Like,
yeah.
So there's the two things that the British were good at, bureaucracy and colonizing. So
no offense to those of you who are British, but it's probably somewhat inaccurate. Or accurate. I actually, in between our last recording, I have done my first trip to the United Kingdom. I went to Ireland, where they spent a lot of time hating OSHA on British people.
Well, you know, it's fun to do. I mean, especially since the British colonized, you know, like most of the world for a while. So it's, yeah, it's kind of like being, yeah, mad.
And the Irish are real, real mad. And like, you know, when you hear it from their side, you're like, yeah, I get it. I get it.
I just remember, so she's in Ireland, sending me text messages. And my mom also went with her, and they went bar hopping in Ireland. I'm at home with the 4-year-olds trying to get over jet lag from
Ireland. Yeah, so after Norway, mom and I went to Ireland because that's just how we roll. And Portia and fam went home.
so we're texting you.
Meanwhile, like, yeah, after the thing that we did, that was my job related, then we all went out with the people who hosted us. And first of all, we went to Riverdance, which was amazing. And then we went out drinking with Irish people. And then I died, and mom could hang all night. And it was like, oh my God, what's happening here? Because, of course, mom's like, just having all the alcohols and doing fine, even though she weighs like 90 pounds now.
But she's healthy, so her body's healthy. Like...
Yeah. But like, you know, she's 80. She's literally 80 and 90 pounds, and like she's hanging with them, like drink. And maybe she was good at pacing herself, but I swear she was trying all those baby Guinnesses with me. Woof.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but it's just, you know, I just was so like, because we're busy trying to get the kids not to sleep during the day and not to wake up at 4 a.m. and all these things. And then mom's like, "Woo, I'm going to the next bar." And I'm like, fuck all of you. That's great. Anyway, so yeah, we had a summer.
Yeah, we did.
But anyway, so Charles. So Charles and Sophia
Right, back to England.
Busy colonizing. Is that the new Bobby ate a sandwich? The British were colonizing. So they were in Cairo, or yeah, I think.
And
Cairo.
He falls in love with a woman named Sophia. And she's a good listener, but I barely know anything about her. And then finally, by the end of their interaction, he's like, wait, I don't just like chatting to her. I'm in love with her. But he says, you know, there's too much up in the air right now. We're both going to go our separate ways because it's the end of the war, but I will find you. We will meet up. And then at that point I'll propose. And it was actually a mature way of being like, I'm realizing I love you, but it wasn't like, I'm not going to propose to you now. I don't want to be engaged or married now because we both are like, but it's kind of like, I'll see you later. And hopefully if things work out, we will still get engaged. What were you going to say?
Oh my God. I love this. That entire thing. If I could quote that entire thing, their entire interaction, and give it to every young person who's like, but I love them. And I'm like, great. And he said, and this book was written in 49. And so I'm like, I want to be like, in 1949, this was said, right? Like, hey, if we get engaged now, and then we don't see each other for a couple of years, you're going to feel tied down and resentful. And
you're going to meet somebody else, and it's going to be awkward and all that.
And then, and if we, you know, so let's just say I love you and I'd like to get married to you when we meet up in a couple of years when the war is totally over. And just leave it at that. I'll find you in a couple of years. And it was so much faith in love, right? Like that. But also,
but realistic, like, and you know, like it's faith and love, but it's not like we love each other, so we must get engaged now. It's like we love each other, and I think it's gonna work out, but we're gonna see. Like, it was definitely like it was both faith and love, but also a mature sort of like. But sometimes these things don't work out, and if you get engaged to me, you're gonna feel weird, or
right, because because the end of the war is so chaotic. And who knows where he was going to be stationed and who knows where she was going to be stationed. And so like, why be tied down like that? And I love that. And I also loved it. I mean, Agatha Christie doesn't make references to, because this is, she never does, but I could imagine if she were writing it now, she might be like, yeah, go and sleep with other people. I'm not going to see you for 2 years, right? Like, you know, because if you're engaged and then you don't see somebody for 2 years,
right?
Then it's just like, great, you know what I mean? And so, or whatever years. I mean, it turned out to be two, but it could have been, who knows?
Right, he didn't really know.
So, but Agatha Christie would never talk about sex like that. But I could see that being part of the conversation, or maybe that's what she meant. But I love that whole thing.
Or at least, like, for you, like, yeah, right. So you could see it in a sexual way, but you could also just see it like, don't make it awkward because you're going to go off to a different chapter and I don't want you to feel like beholden to me if things change in your life. And it was very super mature, and it wasn't like we must grasp to each other because, again, like, there's a way of sort of like, you're going on to a new chapter, so let's grasp to each other and bound ourselves to each other in a way that ends up making it awkward later. Or they're sort of like, yeah, I really hope I see you again. It was very mature.
I'm going to show you where I am in my life, and I'm going to make a Frozen 2 reference.
Oh, Frozen 2 is amazing. I don't have kids, but, like, it's so good. So,
but, you know, when she goes off to rescue her sister, and then Anna goes off to rescue her sister, or to rescue the world at that point, then he runs... the guy she loves finds her, and he's like, what can I do? And she's like, I'm sorry I left. And he goes, it's okay, my love isn't fragile. And that's a little bit over your head with the message, right? Of like, you can leave and I still love you.
Right.
My love isn't fragile, but I do appreciate that Disney doesn't say, oh God, we can't ever be apart.
You shouldn't have gone. Right.
So, but anyway, like so I just love the beginning of the book. I just loved it. Cause I'm like, that is so smart. I love you. I'll see you when we get back to England in a couple of years or so. Right.
Yeah, totally.
Just love that. So anyway, he does, he comes back and he's in England, and he reaches out to her before he even reaches out to his dad. He apparently doesn't have a mother. Because she never comes up.
Yeah, his mother does not come up.
And reaches out. And Sophia had briefly mentioned that she lives in a house with her grandfather, her step-grandmother, her mother, her father, her brother, her sister.
Her aunt.
Her aunt and her uncle, and then a great aunt.
Oh, yeah, and her great aunt.
And so, and he's like, whoa. And then she mentions her grandfather being a wonderful guy that she really admired. And that's all that he had really heard, that he was a wonderful guy. And he was a Greek immigrant to London, or to England. And then he comes.
She made a comment that makes references the title of the book from the beginning. She's like, oh yeah, we all live together in a crooked house. And to like, that makes reference to that nursery rhyme.
There was a crooked man who lived in a crooked house.
Of course, you're giving me Iggy face. You gotta give me some more face.
What?
Iggy from the 80s. You gotta give, you're just giving me nosing up. You gotta move your camera. Tilt it down. I'm just kidding. Eyes and forehead. Thank you.
I'm sorry.
I know you hide your own camera, but then I just end up like with these funny shots where I'm just like, what am I seeing here?
I'm sorry. I'm actually gonna you're gonna not see me for a second because I'm gonna go get myself some more spiked tea. But so don't panic, because I know how you panic. Going back to it.
I'm panicking. Actually, I'm gonna do the same. While you're doing that, I'm gonna make you panic too.
Okay.
I'm gonna be on the moves, but I have to take you with me because my headphones are connected to my device.
So anyway, where did we leave off when we were talking about
No idea. Absolutely no idea.
Oh, yeah. She explained her family's briefly, and that it was her grandfather was Greek. And then he comes back to England for the first time.
And he had realized that she, he's like, you know what? She's such a good listener. We're always talking about me, but I don't know anything about her. So he finally overtly asked once, but it actually took him actually overtly, because she was like, yeah, that's kind of weird. So she admitted that.
And I appreciate that, because of course that could be a problem with cis males sometimes, where they're just like, she's such a great listener, and they never occur to say,
right, it did occur to him. I was like, wait a minute, I don't know anything about this chick. I like her, but what? So yeah, it seemed good that he, that did dawn on him.
And also, I don't remember him talking about her looks so much as he talked about her brains.
I don't know if we ever knew what she looked like attractive, not attractive. Like, I can make assumptions knowing that she's half Greek, but like, literally, we, in terms of like attractiveness in women and our like our complaints about Agatha Christie and how she sometimes does that, like, I don't remember any comments.
Right.
Like, she was beautiful, or she was plain, or she was hideous, but so smart. Like, none of that. I have no idea. I just knew that he liked her.
And that she was smart. That he was like, she was smart.
Yeah, she was definitely smart.
And like, had a good position in the Foreign Office. So she was really good at her colonizing bureaucracy. Thank you for appreciating that joke. I said that entirely for you.
Colonizing bureaucracy? Yes.
Yes, yeah. So he gets back to England, and the first thing he does is like, hey, let's go out to dinner, because we're both in England now. And then he sees a notice that her grandfather had died. And he's like, oh God, I'm so sorry. I think your grandfather died. And she's like, okay, I'll see you at dinner. And then he goes to see his dad, which, you know, priorities. I mean, there is that. He did not see her for 2 years. And I also, the self-awareness, the way that Agatha Christie describes this, where he's like, a Frenchman would have been really disappointed in our greeting. But we really did, he said, he didn't even say, I love my dad. He said, we were very fond of each other. But it was such the most British way of saying, I love my dad so much. And we said, hey, what's up? And he calls him old man, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the most, like, British, like, I don't do affection kind of way, but admitting it out loud, like in a way that, like, I love my dad very much, we just never do affection.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I liked Charles because of his self-awareness in that way.
Right. Yeah, his self-awareness was nice generally.
But anyway, he goes out to dinner with
wait, but is this, doesn't the woman bear her soul first before he sees his dad?
Right, you're right, you're right, you're right.
So he sees the girl, and he's like, yay, we love each other, let's do this. And she's like, but my grandfather, oh, because the reason he even called her was he saw there was two notices in the paper about her grandfather dying.
Right, right.
And so he calls her, and he's like, hey, you know, I wanted to get back together anyway, and I saw that your grandfather died. So they get together, and she's like, yes, but my grandfather died, but it's murder and it's crazy and blah. And he's like, well, yeah, he was old and 80 something and, you know, and she's like, no, but it wasn't a natural death. And if everything will be fine, if the right person did it. And then she's all like, dun, dun, dun. And I know your father's a cop, so I'm not going to tell you anything more about that. You find out about it, not from me. And then we'll talk later.
Right. And so,
and I snuck out to even see you because the whole house is under surveillance.
Right. And also, I'm not going to marry you until we figure this out.
Right. And we've had this theme before in other Agatha Christie books where it's like, when there's a suspicion on the house, people don't feel like they can just go on and like get engaged and live their lives because it's like the suspicion of murder over the house. And that does make sense.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I understand that. But it was interesting because she was pretty matter of fact, like, you need to come and help. You've got connections. Come and help and look at it from outside eyes. So she doesn't say much about anybody who lives there or anything. She just says, my grandfather's murdered and we can't do anything until we figure this out.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
So then he goes and hangs out with the old man, which was, you know, what was confusing about Charles calling him his dad, the old man, is that his dad is not as old as the old man who was murdered. So I kept thinking, is he?
Oh, you were getting confused by that.
Right. Was he saying the old man, meaning the murdered? Oh, no, that's what he calls his dad. And it actually is a sign of affection.
and that's not crazy. Like,
no. I mean, other people do that. Yeah.
That's an American expression also.
Oh, yeah. I just was easily confused. You know? Yeah. No, I'm not saying it was crazy. I'm just saying I was easily confused. So anyway, so he goes and meets with the old man, his dad. And then his dad is like, oh, and it's like, I couldn't tell if Scotland Yard was called in because it was a big deal, or Scotland Yard actually had, I think Scotland Yard had jurisdiction over the area. It was close enough to London that it was like.
Yeah, because it was part of London.
Yeah.
It was an area of London, definitely.
So then they explain that he was killed because somebody put his eye drops into his insulin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the name of the Eserine.
Yeah, Eserine.
Anyway.
Yeah, so basically, what happened was is that our main character's girlfriend, Sophia,
mm-hmm.
her grandfather, who's in his 80s, had married a woman, maybe let's say 10 years ago he married a woman. When he was in his 70s, he married a 20-something-year-old.
Which,
right?
Yes, he was.
So now she's in her 30s. And so anyways, he's got diabetes because he's old. And so every night, you know, she would give him insulin injections for his diabetes. And then what happened was that injection, like someone had swapped his eye solution for the insulin, which was instant death.
Right. They poured it in or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
So then he died. So that was the poison. And then, but there was a full household. So
wait, Portia, how's the play going? Why can you meet with me? I sort of assumed when I reached out to you to record this week, I thought you'd be like, no, stop with the play. It's not going to happen.
Well, because it's supposed to open in 2 weeks.
The people what you're doing.
So we're doing Little Mermaid, and as a trans allegory, as opposed to a girl who gives up everything for a man.
Are you doing it as a trans allegory?
Well, not. I mean, we haven't changed
like in your heads.
But we're truly trying to emphasize the fact that she wanted to be part of that world and told everybody she didn't belong in her world the whole time before she ever met the dude.
Right. It's true.
And so we're just trying to be like, she's trying to tell everybody she was born in the wrong body.
Mm-hmm. She's trans species.
And then she does a deal with the devil, which is her aunt, in order to try to, you know, become part a human. Didn't go well. But then the story arc is that her dad at the end is like, oh, I still love you, even though you're human, not mermaid.
Did you end up watching the live action version yet?
I have not, because I just haven't had time. Have you?
Melissa McCarthy is a treasure as Ursula.
I did see her a couple of scenes.
I heard criticism, and we might have said this on the last recording, but I heard criticism of that because like they wanted to be a drag queen or whatever, but like she killed it. And they were going to give us a drag queen. They're not going to give us a black Ariel and an assigned male at birth
Ursula. Yeah.
And like Melissa McCarthy is not a drag queen.
Right. I mean,
she killed it. I thought she was one of the strongest roles in the movie.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And we have two cis females playing Ursula because we double cast Ursula. But we've told them up front that Ursula the drag queen, like that's You know what I mean? Like, we're,
yeah,
everything's over the top, the makeup is over the top, the acting, you know what I mean? Like, you're trying to, so, we've emphasized that part because it's interesting because, of course, Queen Latifah did a live version of Ursula when they did Little Mermaid Live. And then the original Ursula in the 89 movie was played by a woman, but it's like, yeah, like it.
But the inspiration was supposed to be divine.
Divine, yeah, and yeah, definitely, yeah. Yeah.
But you're right, it was always played by a woman doing like that kind of like over the top. Yeah,
anyways, right.
But I thought Melissa McCarthy did great.
Yeah, yeah, and I've seen some scenes from it actually because there was a couple of times that I was like, ooh, what'd they do with this? But I haven't seen the whole thing. But I did see her sing Poor Unfortunate Souls, which is like actually a really hard song because of the range, which you don't really think about.
Is that true?
Yeah, because of the, yeah, so it's actually that's actually a particularly hard song. We had trouble casting the role because it's such a hard song because nobody was doing it right.
Ooh.
And we finally got two girls that are strong and, you know, could do the hit song.
Wait, why do you have two people doing it?
We have been doing that for the last several years. So we have two Ariels and two Ursulas.
Okay, so it's like just you have A cast and B cast.
Exactly. Although we're calling it Ocean and Sea because you don't want to say A and B because that sounds like
you're it sounds like you're junior, like JV and
right, exactly. Varsity. So we have Ocean cast and Sea cast. And we've done that before. Like we did that.
Yeah, it gets more people the experience and
right. And then there's some shows, especially shows that were movies first, like Wizard of Oz or The Sound of Music, that it's really hard on the leading lady because they're in every freaking scene. Because in a movie, that doesn't matter if you're in every scene because like you cut it and then you go take a break. But in a play, if you're in every scene, you don't get a break. You know what I mean? Like, so
yeah.
Sound of Music and Wizard of Oz, like there's no scene without the leading lady. And then you're like exhausted, right?
Yeah.
We probably didn't need to double cast Ursula. That just is giving more people a chance to have.
No, but yeah, why not? If you had two good candidates, why not?
Yeah, yeah. So, but yeah, especially because I'm noticing that if the musical was first on Broadway, then they know how to be like, we'll have scenes without the major, the leads, so they can go off stage and have a drink of water or pee, you know?
Right. And then know that they have a math test tomorrow and like.
Right. But right. But the ones that were movies first, they have more trouble with that because people are like, but what is the scene that doesn't have the main character in it?
Yeah, where's Dorothy in all this? She's always right. There. Ariel's in every scene. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
But anyway, so double casting. So we do that. But yeah, I mean, it's going well. And I'm excited because I've been inviting, you know, my children's preschool mates to come and see it. You know,
so fun.
Yeah. So, and it's the most I've ever been involved. Oh, I'm on the poster.
You're on the poster,
right? So
do you have one in your house? Show it to me.
Oh, okay.
People on the podcast want to see this visual that they cannot see because it's a podcast.
Did you just quote?
I will describe it visual vividly.
You just quoted Love It or Leave It.
All right, she's walking, there's more walking, she's grinning and walking. Okay, so there's a mermaid on a thing. Oh, it's Portia's name, not her.
Okay. Right. I'm not, yeah.
Okay, so there's an animated mermaid on the thing, and if she stops moving, if this Blair Witching stops, I'll be able to see. Okay.
Well, what's funny is that Disney has all these legal requirements. You know, it says Disney, the little thing.
So you have to do that.
Right. And then it has the names of the people who wrote it on the poster. We've done posters, and we usually do student artwork, and all we have is the name,
right,
the dates, and Franklin High School and how to buy tickets. But no, we had to put music by, lyrics by, book by, based on Hans Christian Andersen's story and the Disney film.
You have to do right? all that to meet the Disney thing.
And then it's got directed by and choreographed by, and so that's where I come in.
Wait, okay, but bring it closer to the camera so I can see that. Okay, and bring it to the others. Okay, projected by John Forth Sith and Portia Hall! Woo! Choreographed by Sonya Killerman and Portia Hall! She's on the poster twice.
I am on the poster twice because I have, you know, important jobs.
That's so awesome!
Yeah. Anyway, so, but it's funny because we've never done that because we usually do our own posters that just have that, but the Disney, like, formulated.
Yeah, I have the one for Chicago up in my on my wall.
Right.
But and it doesn't have all those credits and stuff. But like, yeah, if you're going to credit Hans Christian Andersen, you better give credit to Portia Hall.
Right? I mean, Hans Christian Andersen is like super dead.
And he wrote a horrific story.
Right.
So many horrific stories.
I mean, but Disney has milked multiple.
It's true.
Anyway, so it's going well, but yeah, I mean, it's hard because the main thing is trying to figure out, because the kids miss me, my kiddos miss me, you know what I mean, you know, and so I've been working late, and so trying to make sure that they have enough mommy time, but it's supposed to, you know, it'll be done in 2 weeks, and then there'll be plenty of mommy time, but it's hard to explain to a kid. Oh, you haven't seen mommy all day and she's late because of this, right? Like a 4-year-old, you know what I mean? So I feel like, but anyway, I feel really, I feel pretty good. I'm having,
yeah, that's I didn't realize this was the most involved you've ever been.
No, I don't know if it's the most involved I've ever been.
Definitely since kids.
Since kids for sure. It's the most I've been involved in 5 years for sure. So
but still, I mean, like, yeah, is this on par with Chicago or more than Chicago or?
It's about the same as Chicago. Yeah, in terms of how my involvement. As it says, directed by Josh and me, and we really have been splitting the duty, but I've been doing most of the acting work and he's been doing most of the, like, creating the sets. But he's been taking one day a week off to spend with his aging ill mother. Mm. We understand how that works. And I've been taking one day a week off because my kids need to see me so that I'm not coming home late every week. And so it really is nice because he and I have worked together for so many years that, like, when we block a scene, we'll be like, oh, I see what you did there. And, you know, like, we know how each other works.
You speak, yeah, that's great. That's really comfortable.
So I still did more of, like, the directing of scenes than he did, but he also did some of the scenes, right? Like, it's, so we definitely shared the directing of that, but he also is the one who chose the play and built the sets. And so he's kind of like the producer as well, which producers don't get credit on there. And then, like, Sonya choreographed the big dance numbers that had, like, a bunch of things. And then there was a tap number. So he did, but she did 4 dance numbers. And I did 10, but they were less dancey and more.
You're really good at doing the, like, how do I get these people who have had dance 101 or less to look coordinated in a chorus, right? Like,
well, and like, yeah, and but also I was doing the, I'm singing a song and I can't just stand in one spot.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because often the singers have, that's what I'm saying, the dance 101 less, they have right. zero dance, and you're like, don't just stand there, you have to move around. Like, how do you feel? Like, to teach a non-dancer dance things, I think you're really talented with that.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, and so, like, but
it's how to make the, like, actors look, like, less awkward.
Right, it's more like, because of course, if this were a TV show, when someone is singing, like, a ballad, they could stand in one spot and the camera zooms in and comes out, but you can't do that.
And you show the background dancers and do all that stuff, but yeah, you can't.
So, like, because when she's singing Part of Your World, she can't just stand in one spot. So it's like, no, walk over here. and sing over there, then walk over here, you know what I mean? And then you wave your arm. So it's not really dancing as much as it's just movement. So
yeah, but that's also really important.
Oh yeah, it makes such a difference. Yeah. So there's a phrase, I didn't come up with it, I stole it from somebody, about like, you don't just park and bark. Stand in one spot and sing. So
that's awesome,
because that gets boring if someone stands in one spot and sings.
Park. That's funny.
Yeah. So on Friday, Chris brought the kids to rehearsal, and they got to see them run through some of the songs.
Have your kids watched either of the Little Mermaids?
We started watching the cartoon one pretty early on. And we got half an hour in, and they were not very interested.
Interesting.
But also, I think the live action one, from what I've seen, is too realistic. Might be too scary. Because of the realism, you know what I mean? Like, it's scary looking eels and scary looking, you know.
Yeah, totally.
But I thought the cartoon one wouldn't be too bad, but
they were into it.
They weren't into it. And it's not like we haven't watched new Disney movies. We watched the original Rescuers recently. And last night we watched
old Disney movies.
Yeah. Last night we watched the 2011 Winnie the Pooh. Which I did not know there was a 2011 Winnie the Pooh, but it's really good. But apparently it came out the same exact day as Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. So it totally flopped.
Part two. I don't know if I've seen that either. And I'm a huge Winnie the Pooh fan.
Yeah. And John Cleese is the narrator, and Zoe Deschanel does the Winnie the Pooh song. Yeah, I mean, it's a really well...
But 2011, I probably missed that too. But yeah, if it came out the same day as Harry Potter.
Yeah, so... they were not into the 89 Little Mermaid for some reason, so... and of course, at the rehearsals, I'm really like, those are frogs, and those are seagulls, and he's a crab. And they're looking at me like, what? Because they're not wearing any of their costumes, you know, like... Anyway, so it'll be different when they actually go and see the show when it's all done.
Wait, so the show is in 2 weeks?
Yeah, opening night is in 2 weeks, so yeah. But we should probably get back to this.
Oh, wait, we're doing a book. This is the book podcast.
Not just update on my, side gig.
It's, you know, your musicals are fun. It's fun to talk about. Okay, so back to this murder.
Oh, yeah, we have it. Where were we? Oh, yeah, he's talking to the old man, and the old man explains everybody who's living in this
house. Oh, yeah, his old man, his dad.
Right, his old dad.
Who he called. So he's back to London, he meets up with his old boo after 2 years, and she's like, yeah, I love you, but my grandpa died, and it was murder, so it's awkward. I need you to hear about it from not me, and I know your dad's a cop. So then he meets up with his cop dad, and his cop dad's like, yeah. Okay, so you're into this girl. Well, here's what we know about the murder.
Right. And so he explains all the people who live in this house, which is too many. So
And some of it has to do with it being war. Like, someone's house got bombed.
Right.
And so, like, it wasn't necessarily by design that everyone was living under the same roof, but everyone's living under the same roof now.
Right. So
this is post Blitz and post other things, other war reasons for everyone to be living there.
So here's the people. So there's the guy who died, the grandfather so Aristide, who was 88, and his 34-year-old wife or something like that.
Brenda,
who lived in a completely different wing.
Seemed like a duplex situation where they, like, he and Brenda lived in, like, one part of the house, or maybe like a Beauty and the Beast thing, like a, you know, like they lived in one side of the house and then like everybody else lived in the other side of the house. But like, it was continuous and there was no like real like locked doors between it, but there was sort of like a duplex where it was like you're in this house or that house.
So when people are like, did you see him? And, you know, what do you think? People kept asking, the whole family, what did you think of Brenda, the step grandmother? And they're like, I never see her because she lived in this other part of the house. So then Philip, who was Aristide's second son and Sophia's dad, and his wife Magda, who was an actress, who was apparently good-ish at being an actress. No, she was good at being an actress, but picked her projects terribly.
Right. So this is Sophia, our main character's boo, Sophia's mother.
Right.
Is Magna, and she's an actress, but I think the book has the opinion that because she wasn't ever a starving artist, she kind of like, she could have been great if she had to just take roles, but because she was never a starving artist because her father was wealthy, she could sort of like pick and choose. And then like, now that she's older, sort of like bully people into changing roles for her. And there was a comment about how her having to do comedy because of her looks, but she wants to do different kind of roles. And so I feel like she's probably not as pretty as maybe the traditional actress, but like, so the book has the opinion that she would have been very successful if she had had to struggle, but because she was independently wealthy, was sort of like she was stuck up about roles.
She married wealth because her husband was the one who was. We forgot to say Aristide Leonidas is ridiculously wealthy. All of these people are ridiculously wealthy.
But it's all his wealth. Yeah, Aristide was. Yeah, he was a businessman, and from the beginning, we're introduced to. Again, this is one of our themes, sort of being like, is it racist or ethno something? Like, they're like, he was Greek and he was not ethical. And like, he wouldn't break the law, but he would do things that were not correct, clearly not ethical. And then have to like change the law because of things he did to be like, oh, that's a way someone could take advantage of the system. And so
when Howie made his money was one restaurant and then a series of restaurants and then a catering company. But he was apparently really, really good at making money.
Yeah, he was really good at making money and really good at seeing where the loopholes in the law were. So right. The law was literally like chasing him in terms of like, oh shit, that's a loophole. We need to close up.
Right.
So I felt like it was slightly, I don't think you could use racist, but something about like Greek people being less ethical.
Right. Yeah. So they definitely had that. But, and this is one of our themes. So we reviewed Hercule Poirot's Christmas a long time ago, over a year ago for sure. And it was about a patriarch who lived in a house, had a lot of money, and all of his kids lived there, and he died. And the question was, who killed him? In this one, same question, right? Patriarch, bunch of people in the house. Big difference. Everyone loved Aristide. Everyone loved him. And he wasn't stingy with his money. He was incredibly generous.
Right. He had basically, what he did was at some point he was like, I mean, I'm going to die anyway. And he basically gave his kids all his money. And
then he started over.
And he started over and made a whole bunch of new money.
Right.
Because he's just really good at business. But he had already given, he basically had divided up his whole fortune among his kids at that point.
And he had a bunch of kids. But the only two that were left were Philip the younger and Roger the older. But I'll finish Philip's family first. So Philip was the younger, who was a historical scholar who basically read books and wrote about history. And then his wife, who was the actress. And then he had three kids. Sophia, who was the oldest, who was an adult. Eustace, who was a teenager.
And no, she was 12.
No, Eustace, not Josephine. Eustace.
Oh, yeah. He's 16, sorry.
Yeah, Eustace, who was a teenager, who was away at school and then caught polio because the vaccines work and now nobody gets that, but he got polio and it messed him up. So he had come home, and then Josephine, who was 12.
Okay, so, got it. Yep, you got it.
So those, that's Philip's family. And they just lived at this house and always had. I mean, I think Magda would go away and do plays in London, but Philip wanted all his books and just wanted to be a place with his books.
Right.
And as I said, it Aristide gave them money and a place to live, and but didn't really interfere day to day, right? He didn't say, you must do this, or you have to do patronage or anything.
No, no, he was very like, yeah, he didn't interfere a lot.
And then there was the other brother, the oldest brother. I don't know if he was the oldest or just the oldest who lived, because I know there were other kids that didn't survive. But anyway, Roger.
Roger, yeah.
Who was described as a big, friendly dog. Big, super friendly, dumb dog. Who is like super nice and just like, but not, you know, but kind of dumb, but friendly and, you know, like a big dumb dog. And he was the oldest, and Aristide had given him the catering company, just was like, here, have run the catering company. And he was married to a woman who was, has the unfortunate name Clemency, which is a, seems like a adverb or
no, it's not, I think it's a noun, but not a proper one. Like, isn't clemency like when you're not going to get charged with a crime?
Right. Like granting clemency. Right.
Let's see. Clemency definition. Mercy. Yeah, it's like the clemency of the court. Lenience. What does it mean when someone gets clemency?
So that's an interesting
clemency term. Is defined as leniency granted for a crime. Yeah, so that's an interesting name.
Anyway, so Roger's married to Clemency. So this is another theme of the book. All of the marriages seem to be happy.
Yeah.
So Aristide's first marriage was happy, and he had married a British woman who was not necessarily upper class, but like middle class.
And I mean, I think she was, I thought she was at least county.
Right, but didn't have money.
Yeah.
And then she died.
Enough for her parents to disdain her marrying a Greek guy.
Right. And they had a happy marriage, but she died when their youngest kid was one. So her sister came and lived and took care of the kids. So this is back in the, before the wars. So like way back. And so, but they had a happy marriage. And then he married Brenda when he was in his 70s and she was in her 20s. And actually, everybody seemed to say that it was as well as one of those goes, happy. But then also Roger and Clemency marriage, happy.
Right.
Philip and Magda seemed to be
right.
Happy.
Like the family hated his young wife, but they actually couldn't say, like, it seemed like, yeah, she liked fancy things.
Right. They described her as a cat. Not like a spiteful cat, but like a purring.
Yeah, like she liked to have nice things and she appreciated, and she had been a shop girl before he married her. And like the story was that she had become pregnant out of wedlock, and he was like, I'll marry you. And then like the pregnancy didn't resolve, or maybe it was a lie the whole time. But either way, he married her and she enjoyed being married to a rich man and having nice things, but they were actually happy together, even though she was like 50 years younger than him.
Yeah. I mean, if you are a regular listener to this, you know how Amanda and I feel about some of these relationships. Although, you know, what's half?
I don't think anyone has to like be like, wait, Amanda and Portia thinks it's weird to have a 50-year age gap. It's not like we're the outliers.
I'm not saying we're the outliers, but we have mentioned this before, our strong opinion on it. But I could not tell if this marriage was, shall we say, consummated.
Oh, gross! Yeah, see, you always go there. You always go there.
I could not tell, but it also didn't seem to matter. It seemed to be that they enjoyed each other at the level that they wanted to enjoy each other.
Yes, exactly, right? Right, and it's sort of like, you know, with Sarah Paulson and Holland Taylor, you're like, I don't want to know if they're doing sexy things. I just know that they're happy. And it's gross to think about if they're doing sexy things. So, but just, you know, they're happy, you know? They're
nice. So, anyway, so like, again, very different from Hercule Poirot's Christmas. Again, this was an old rich patriarch that was killed, but unlike that, he wasn't surrounded by toxic marriages. And Charles and Sophia obviously were leading towards, you know, saying that they loved each other and they wanted to get married, but they weren't going to do it until this was over. Like, all of that seemed to be marriages that people loved each other and they...
Right. It's so true. You're right. You make a good point there.
So, anyway. Anyway. So, this is why I seem like the backwards mirror image of that other one. Because in that other one...
Of Hugo Poirot's Christmas.
The guy died and it's like, oh my God, who could have killed him because everyone hated him? And in this one, it's, oh my God, who could have killed him because everyone loved him? Also, in that one, everyone desperately needed money from the rich old patriarch. And so it was like everybody had money as a motive.
And in this one, initially, it doesn't seem like anybody needs money because he'd given them all his money.
Right. And then it turned out that Roger had been an absolute terrible businessman, and he totally ran the catering business into the ground and totally, but then it also turned out that his dad was like, okay, I'll rescue the business and was going to do it. So he again had no motive to kill his dad.
Maybe it wasn't going to happen because his dad died.
Right. Right. And so it was like, there was absolutely no money, no motive to kill him. And then the will, the original will, which everybody seemed to know about and had seen, he had signed
very publicly
in about a year before, that said £100,000 to his wife, some to each son, and some to the each grandkids, and that was it. And also, because the cops figured this out pretty early on, that all of his, and I thought this was so smart as a rich person. I'm not a rich person, and so I don't have servants. But he said to all of his servants, every year that you work with me, you will make more money, and I will give you more bonuses for every year you work with me. So that is a motive to never quit, to always be a good servant, and to never kill your...
He'd really thought through that, like, how do I get loyalty? And it's like, oh, the longer I live, the more you get paid. But also, like, you're not getting a legacy when I die. You're getting more and more money as I live.
Right. So it's like, which I'm like, ooh, smart. But like, it's one of those things that I could never use in real life because I don't have a servant that I could be like, I will pay you more money each time you, so it was like, that's what I keep saying. So it was, the marriages were, everybody loved each other. Everybody loved the guy who died. So it's always kind of interesting because in the Agatha Christie books, which, as you know, I prefer if the person who died, everybody hates.
You do. You really do like that.
I prefer that because it's like, then nobody got hurt. Or nobody that we cared about got hurt.
Or it was like, either way, someone got murdered, but like the people who are still alive are less hurt if it's a bad person.
Right.
Whereas like when a good person dies, the people who are still alive are really hurt by that.
Right, right. So anyway, so those are all the people involved. So then Charles has this great thing where I love how he comes into the house because his dad's like, go and figure out this on my behalf. And he's like, you want me to be a police spy? And he's like, but I'm trying to marry this girl. And he was like, I bet that's what she wants too. And he goes to her and he's like, I'm so sorry. And Sophia's like, oh my God, you're a police spy? Hell yes.
Yeah.
But also everyone knows he's a spy because...
Yeah, they know that's his dad. His dad came along and then, yeah.
So they both know that that he wants to marry Sophia and that he is related to and close to the cops who are busy investigating the murder. So, but what I love is it's so funny in the first part of the book when Charles goes to the house and he goes from room to room and nobody asks who he is.
Yeah, and he even says to his dad, like, who do I say I am? And he's like, are they asking? And he's like, well, no. He's like, well, then just don't let them not ask.
I mean, it was so funny because he's like, wait a minute. No one's asking. And, you know, he keeps wanting, he feels like he should explain who he is and wants to come up with an answer, but nobody's asking.
Yeah. Like, am I here as like her boo? Am I here as your son? And the dad was like, is anybody asking? He's like, no.
So, and he talks, I mean, Magda sees him as an audience. Philip just ignores him, you know, but then they people start talking to him and sharing with him. We forgot about Lawrence. The tutor.
The tutor. I was like, wait, the tutor. Yep.
So Lawrence, Brown, and I just looked at the name. That's why I remember the last name because I would. But anyway, when Eustace got polio and had to leave school and came home, they wanted to have him keep learning. So they got a tutor and that he's been teaching Eustace and Josephine. And he's in his 30s. And Brenda, who is married to Aristide, is in her 30s.
Right.
So
he was a conscientious objector to the war. So there was a lot of discussion around that.
Right. A lot of judgmentalness about that. They don't say what Charles did in the war, but I'm assuming it was kill Nazis.
Right.
Or
at least so, bureaucrat around killing Nazis.
Right. But yeah, Lawrence was a conscientious objector. And so I think Agatha Christie thinks conscientious objectors are cowards.
I mean, when he gave his speech about, like, if I shoot a guy, how do I know if it's a Nazi or just some guy from a village who was forced into signing up? I was like, it was not persuasive. And, like, of course, I'm a conscientious objector type, but I didn't think it made him sound like a fool. I thought it made him sound like a thoughtful person.
Oh, I totally did. Yeah.
Which is why I didn't get the opinion that Agatha Christie felt that way, because it wasn't like, I just was worried, what if I get shot? Like, it was like, no, what if I get out there and I've got a gun to someone's head and, like, I'm going to shoot them because they're a Nazi, but, like, maybe they're just, like, some guy from a village who's been forced to join this war.
Yeah, and you're right. And also,
so I didn't think the book hated him.
I didn't think the book hated him, but I don't know. It was something about the way she wrote it that, because she also described him as scared all the time of Charles. And I got the sense that Agatha Christie, like, just had that opinion. But she also made him, much to Charles' surprise, a fabulous teacher.
Right.
That, you know.
And one of the other, I guess it was Sophia, was like, oh, you don't think he has sex appeal? He's got sex appeal. Because Charles was like, oh, nobody's going to like that wussy guy who's kind of, like, scared of his own shadow. And Sophia was like, nah, he's got it. And, like, he's definitely, like, referring to her own self. Like, no, he's cute.
Well, and it's interesting because Charles and Sophia, I think, are in their 20s. And then Brenda and Lawrence are in their 30s, which, you know, like, that's not too far apart. But I think one of the things that comes up in the first half of the book, for sure, is that everybody is hoping that it's Brenda because she isn't really part of the family.
Right. Like, yeah, because she's the 50 years younger wife
who's only been
around not a part of the family, and they never really accepted her. So they're like, oh, of course, It will be so much easier for all of us if it's her and maybe this tutor who she may or may not be having an affair with. That would be great our story, for the narrative, for the family. We don't have to worry about one of the family members having killed him.
And they were also, some of them were really hoping that the two, Brenda, the step-grandmother, and the tutor were having an affair. Like,
right, there was a lot of speculation about that.
So, anyway, so I forgot to have...
No, that's a really good way to set up the set. Shall we do a break?
I agree. Let's do a break.
Okay, we'll be right back.
That break turned into a couple of months, so look out for the part 2 in the next episode.